Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Good morning, and thanks for joining me on the Garden Show. It's a sizzling weather out there, but we did have some cooler weather this week, and we'll see some 80s popping up here and there. And, you know, we should be great. It's hard to be grateful for muggy days in the mid to upper 80s. I mean, nobody says that's comfortable, but you know, when the alternative is humid days with temperatures of 95 or the upper 90s and heat indexes way above 100 degrees, we just kind of take our little good things where we can find them. And during this time of the year, a daytime high in the 80s is a good thing rather than a bad thing. It's hot and uncomfortable as it is. And that, of course, was because of the cloud cover and the rain we had. Numerous showers last week, so you've probably been looking at kind of a soggy situation. When we do get rain like that, I always say it's a good time to walk around your yard, your landscape, look at your beds. I hear you can discover if you have any drainage issues. Is there a bed that's staying, you know, wet? Maybe one end of it is staying damper or wetter than the other end, or maybe there's a low area in your lawn where the water tends to gather, and then it just kind of hangs around there. And even after the rains quit, when you go walking, the ground there feels decidedly wetter. These drainage issues, once you can identify them, then you can do something about them. And, of course, most oftentimes we deal with drainage by, you know, raising the grade some. So a lower level of the lawn would be corrected by bringing in some fill and just filling over that area to raise its level up more with the rest of the lawn so water doesn't drain, accumulate, and settle in that particular location. That could be unhealthy for the lawn. And where beds don't drain as well, you can have plants succumb to root rot. The frequent rain does not allow the soil to properly drain and dry out between the rainfall. And that really needs to happen for the health of the roots. So when we get rain every afternoon, half of an inch here, maybe a couple of inches there, and then another half of an inch, there's just no time for that soil to drain. And the soil is too wet. And what do we mean by soil staying too wet? Well, the soil has a lot of air in it. I mean, you walk on it, you think it's solid, but it's not really solid. There are a lot of pore spaces or open air spaces that are a part of the structure of the soil. And those pore spaces, when it rains, get full of water. And then gravity pulls on that water. It drains deeper into the soil. And as it does so, new air comes in behind it, and the pore spaces go from being full of water. Water drains out, and now they're full of air. The air is critical to the health of the roots. Roots breathe in oxygen, and they breathe out carbon dioxide just like we do. And if the oxygen is not available to them, then they'll begin to get sick and shut down. So saturated soils, overly wet soils, over an extended period. Now, this doesn't happen, you know, in 12 hours. This doesn't happen when it rains and the water's standing all over the place, and then you go out the next day and it's all drained off and everything looks fine. That's okay. It's when it happens over days, over a period of time where the roots just are deprived of oxygen. Now, once they don't get the oxygen that they need, they may begin to shut down. That is, they may begin to stop absorbing water. And if they're deprived long enough, they may begin to die. Well, as these roots get sick, they give off signals, sadly enough, into the soil that attracts organisms called water moles that live in the soil. Phytophthora, Pythium, Rhizoctonia. These are always there in our soils. If you wonder, do I have root rot organisms in my soil? You do. They're just everywhere. They're just part of the soil that we garden in. But when the weather conditions are right, when it's hot, when it's rainy, when the soil stays wet, either because of rain or we do this with irrigation. We over-irrigate plants and cause root rot ourselves on numerous occasions. Well, when that happens, those organisms in the soil attracted to the sick root system attack. And once they attack, we call that disease root rot, and they actually begin to physically kill the roots off. Once the roots are not functioning and they're dying, they're not absorbing the water the plant needs, and the plant can quickly collapse and die of thirst. So root rot ultimately kills plants by killing the roots. That leads to an inability to absorb water, and that leads to the plant dying of thirst. And oddly enough, when a person oftentimes sees a plant struggling with this condition, the upper part of the plant looks thirsty. It does, because it's not getting water from the root system. When it looks thirsty, what do? When a plant looks thirsty, if I walk up to a wilted plant, the first thing I'm going to do is say, oh my goodness, let me give you some water. Well, if you water a plant with root rot, you're just throwing gas on the fire. You're just keeping the soil moist even longer. The only thing we can do to help a plant with root rot is try to get the soil to dry out as fast as possible. You could take a metal rod and plunge it into the ground and make a lot of holes, trying to get some air down in there. Pull the mulch back so that the soil surface can begin to evaporate water. But the last thing you want to do is to water. So how do you know? You see a wilted plant, should I water it or not? Well, check the soil. If you see a plant that is wilted looking or scorched leaves or shows other signs of drought stress and you check the soil and it's damp to wet, then it's oh no. Why isn't the plant absorbing the water that I can see is there in the soil? For goodness sakes, it must have root rot. If you check the soil and it's dry, then you can go, oh, gee, I should have watered you yesterday. Sorry about that. Let me get the hose out and get you a good drink of water. And the plant will spring right back up again. Now, the lesson for that is a plant can tolerate underwatering and being allowed to wilt because you did not water it enough better than it can tolerate overwatering and wilting because the wet soil has allowed the roots to develop root rot. So watering is so important through the summer. It can stay too wet. It can very quickly get to be too dry. Managing irrigation and managing the water level of soils in our lawns and beds is one of the art forms that gardeners have to develop here, really just about in any climate. But here with our intense heat, our soils can dry out so rapidly, we really need to pay careful attention to it. And unlike the Southwest, where all they have to deal with is dryness, you know, we have tropical storms and fronts coming through and all kinds of things that create a lot of rain for us. So we have both extremes, too much water and not enough water. Y'all, it's amazing that any of our landscapes make it through the summer, but they do. We can give them a little help when we need to, and that's what I'm here for this morning. If you've got something going on, wondering what to plant this time of the year, you may have some pest problems, weeds or insects or diseases, you're looking for care of a particular plant you've gotten, you're not sure how to take care of it, if it's green and it's growing, y'all, I'm here to make sure you get the information you need to make those plants grow as good as you want them to. Call me now at WWL on the Mortgage Financial phone line, and that number is 504-260-1870. We're going to take a quick break. Call on in, get your questions lined up. 504-260-1870, and we'll be back right after this. Good morning. We're talking gardening, and do feel free to call on in with your gardening question. That number, once again, is 504-260-1870. Make it a chance to get out and mow that lawn this weekend. So as you walk around looking for those low areas, you're also evaluating, okay, is the lawn dried out enough to mow? And goodness, knows if you can get out there and get it mowed this weekend, you had best, because it's been growing like crazy with all this rain and warm weather. The grass loves it, although we may see some disease problems. So keep an eye out for areas of grass where you might see some browning going on. We've also got sod webworms out there, and that you'll know with a bunch of small moss flying out of your lawn as you walk around looking at your drainage. You're going to go, what are all these little moss flying out as I walk through my lawn? When you see that, that's sod webworms. And if you see that, y'all, I have a great fact sheet on sod webworms. Tells you how to identify the damage, confirm the diagnosis, and what to do and how to help your lawn to recover from it. So don't let that go without getting some information if you've seen those little tan or gray moths, quite small, flying out from your lawn, even from the shrubs around your lawn. As you walk by or brush the shrubs, you'll see them flying out. They don't hurt anything. It's their kids. It's the caterpillars from the eggs that they lay in the lawn that really cause the damage. You can send me a request by email and just send that to dan@wwl.com. dan@wwl.com. All righty, we're going to head to the phones. First up this morning is Richard calling in from Baton Rouge. Hey, Richard, good morning.
Good morning. Got a low spot in the corner. I want to fill it in. You know, probably need 3 or 4 inches of fill. What do you buy? What kind of dirt do you put?
Well, really, it's best to use a soil that has a lot of sand in it. The grass can grow up through the sand. It's just easier to spread as well. You get a heavier soil, and with clay in it, it's lumpy, and you can't spread it very well. It's dense. The grass doesn't grow through it. So you're looking for a sandy kind of soil. Now, you don't want a soil high in organic matter either. And these are oftentimes blended mixes called topsoil or garden soil. If you look at the soil and it's got a lot of organic matter and it ground up organic material, well, if you spread that over the area, when the organic matter decays, it goes away. So you lose that elevation, that fill just doesn't hold up, and that area goes back down again. So you want to avoid heavier soil material, silts. You want to avoid high organic blended soils, something that would be perfect to make a garden bed out of or fill up your raised bed for your vegetable garden would not be suitable for filling in a low area. One of the most common materials that we use here in southeast Louisiana is a fill that we get from the Mississippi River. And sediment is dredged up from the bottom of the river, and it's called river sand. Sometimes it's called pump sand. River sand is about the most common term utilized. And that makes a good soil. Although we call it river sand, it's not like beach sand. It's a sandy, a very fine sandy loam soil. It's got minerals in it. It's not infertile, but it does have that good sandy texture that allows you to fill it easily, spread it, and for the grass to grow up through it. Now, depth is something else, Richard. Grass will reliably grow up through about 2 inches of fill. If we fill deeper than that, the grass may not make it. So you have a couple of choices. First, before you fill, mow the area. You want the grass blade standing upright when the fill is spread. Don't mow it short. Just mow it like you normally would. And then spread 2 inches of the fill. Wait for the grass to grow up through that fill and get reestablished. You're mowing that area again, and then add 2 more inches of fill to finish up that area to the 4 inches that you need it to be. The other option would be to go ahead and put all the fill out at once, see where the grass makes it through the fill, probably around the edges where you didn't have to fill as deep, maybe in the middle. It doesn't show back up because it was too deep there. And then once you've given it a few weeks, a month to come on up through, if it hasn't, go and buy some new sod and just lay enough sod in that area to resod the filled area where the grass did not come back up through, and you've got your lawn redone. You've got the area raised up, and you don't have that low area that tends to collect water anymore. So that gives you a variety of options that you can adjust to your situation and your preferences. But again, river sand is going to be probably the most common material. I will caution people out there particularly in the New Orleans area, where spillway sand, and this is sand that's obtained from the Bonnie Carey spillway area where the river is allowed to flood, the sediment settles out, and then the water is recedes. And they go in and they bulldoze up that sediment, layer of sediment that's been deposited. Well, between the time it's deposited and the time it's bulldozed up and harvested, all kinds of vegetation grows on it out there in that floodplain area. And those are weedy plants that you don't want in your yard. So avoid spillway sand. If you ever see something offered as spillway sand, that's more likely to be contaminated with weeds, including the infamous torpedo grass. You don't want to use that.
Can you buy it at the local garden center?
Oh, by all means, call your local nurseries, the Clegg's Louisiana Nursery up in Baton Rouge.
Right.
Many nurseries have bins of fill. And the cheapest way is if you have a pickup truck, you know, just get a scoop in your pickup. If it's not going to be a very large area, you don't need very much fill, you may be able to get it bagged. But, yeah, contact your local nurseries and garden centers. For a small job like filling a little area, that's probably going to be the way to go. If you've ever got to put out a lot of fill, you need 3 yards or 4 yards or, you know, 6 yards of fill, there are soil companies. Do an internet search for soil companies in your area. And again, you definitely want to buy it bulk at that point. They can either deliver it if you buy enough of it, or you can go get it with a pickup truck.
Well, I don't need that much, so I'll check with one of the local nurseries. Thank you so much.
There you go, Richard. Well, really great question. A lot of people ask about that, and I appreciate you calling in with it.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye. Let's see if we got somebody up next. Let me get that name again. Emily, you're up next, Emily. What can I do for you?
The rain has really made the azalea bushes start with a whole lot of new growth. I was wondering if it's too late to turn them back.
Ooh. The short answer is yes, Emily. We stopped pruning azaleas around about early to mid-July. They begin to set their flower buds around about this time of the year. So you would be interfering with flower buds being set if you cut them back now. The question and what may help out is that there may be time for them to send out more new growth and set flower buds late if you get it done right away. So if you have a real critical need, I mean, if they were overgrown to begin with and now they're sending out new growth and they're really going to be overgrown and it's going to be an issue, then by all means, it'd be better to try to get them under control right now and cross your fingers that they'll have time to reset flower buds. The chances are pretty good that they will. Remember this. It's not unusual for azaleas to put on a late summer flush of growth, rain or not. So remember this and think to yourself, gee, I need to revisit my azaleas in June or early July next year and cut them back hard then if I'm going to expect to try to keep these things under control. So plan on doing 2 prunings a year, the first pruning right after they finish blooming in the spring and the second pruning in midsummer to adjust their height. If you got azaleas that want to be a lot bigger than you want them to be, you're really going to have to work with them to hold them to the size.
These are old plants, and but, you know, I trimmed them right after they bloomed. But this year, it just seems like they've really put on a big spurt here since it rained. And are they going to grow a whole lot more, or this is pretty much what they're going to do for the rest of the year?
A late summer flush is their last. Once they set their flower buds, Emily, they don't grow anymore. They terminate with the flower bud, and there's no growing point at the end of the shoots anymore. So take care now. Y'all, CBS News update. And don't let the program go by without getting your gardening question answered and that information you need to make your plants grow as good as you want them to. That number, once again, 504-260-1870. Let's talk to Steve calling in from Lacombe. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning. How you doing?
Real good. What can I do for you?
I have a question about river birch. I have termite in the tree.
And you want to know what to do next?
Yes.
Yeah, I would remove it, Steve. River birches, we have discovered, are like candy to Formosan termites. We don't know why, but they just absolutely love. I used to live in New Orleans in Algiers Point on the West Bank, right across from the French Quarter, and that was just about ground zero. They arrived at the naval support activity there. That's where the Formosan termites first came in to our estate, and that's sort of the ground zero for Formosan termites. And not realizing that river birches were so prone, one of my favorite trees. I love the size. I love the light shade they cast, the way they move in the wind, those beautiful trunks with the peeling bark. It's just such a great native tree. I planted several and got several of my neighbors to plant these trees along my block. Oh, they're just the perfect size for our neighborhood. They won't get over big and dominate things like the oaks. And, oh, I just sold those trees. Every single one of them within 3 years, 4 years, was attacked by Formosan termites. Living, healthy trees, just attacked by Formosan termites, and they all had to be removed. So where Formosan termites are an issue, which is really all of southeast Louisiana, we have some real problems. The New Orleans area in particular, the North Shore to some degree, not so much once you start getting up towards Baton Rouge, Lafayette, it's not an issue. But boy, in that area where the Formosan termites are, they're likely to find the tree. You can have your, if you have your house under contract for termites, many people do, contact your company, your pest control company. After the tree is removed, you'll want to have them come out and look over the situation and see see what they might recommend you do. Your house should be protected by the termite treatments that have been done over the years. And again, if it's under contract, you can touch base with them. But that's real common with that particular tree species. And unfortunately, you just need to go ahead and take it out.
So, Tony, because I've done several things. I stripped the bark off from about 6 foot up to the ground. The loose bark. I treat it with termite several times.
Well, Steve, they're inside the trunk. You're not reaching okay. them.
Okay. All right. That's because they got the little pinholes. And I have several of those. Okay, that answers that question. Can I ask you one more?
Yeah, now Steve, if it was a tree worth saving, there are techniques that arborists can use. If this was a beautiful old live oak that you wanted to save, it would be worth the fight. And they will actually drill into the trunk and inject foam, a material that will billow up and fill up all the galleries and chambers and can do a good job of eradicating a nest. But again, river mm-hmm. birches just don't have a chance, and they're okay. removed. And I hate to say it, Steve. I know you hate to lose a tree. Yeah. Real quick, Steve, I'm up against the break. What you got?
The tree was, about right at 20 years old, and he can't cut one down. But hey, I agree with you. No, it's got. Yeah, I have my centipede grass. Last year, I had Virginia buckwheat growing in it, and man, it just did damage. And in the fall, I sprayed for weed control, and in the spring, I sprayed. I got rid of all the Virginia buckwheat, but now I have a weed that started in the bark. It looks like mimosa leaves with loose seeds on the back. Now, the spots where the grass hadn't been able to come back,
Steve, let me tell you real quick and give everybody a lesson. When your lawn is damaged, if you ignore the damage and just leave it, these bare areas, these open areas, you're simply inviting an invasion of weeds. So as soon as you saw the damage this spring that had been done by the weed infestation last year, you should have repaired it. You should have raked out the old stuff, loosened the soil, and laid new sod. You just laid out a welcome mat to a weed invasion. So everybody out there, don't just sit back for months and look at damage to your lawn as if it's going to be green one day. It's damaged. It's gone. The grass is no longer in that area. You've got to repair it or you open up the lawn to weed issues. That sounds like gripe weed, Steve. We can't use a lot of herbicides this time of the year, but there is one called Top Shot. It's got metsulfuron in it. Look for some Top Shot either at your local nursery or online. You can use that now. Make two applications, and hopefully that'll help you out with that. Got to run, Steve, up against a break, but good luck with those problems. And again, I'm so sorry to hear the termite issue in the river birch. Y'all, we got a break, but stay tuned. We'll be back with more of The Garden Show. Good morning. We're talking gardening, and we got some room on the line. If you'd like to call in, that number, 504-260-1870. Let's head to the phone to talk to Travis. Calling in from Covington. Travis, good morning.
Good morning, Dan. I'm the first-time caller of the Yes Show, at least, sir. Good morning.
All right. What you got?
What I got is I have a pantry on my grandmother's place in North Covington, just south of Bogalusa. Every year of my childhood, we had cooking pears big as a baseball. I recently returned to try to harvest some of them pears from the property, and the pears are no bigger than a Bing cherry, and I don't understand why.
I don't either. there are pears out there, Travis, that produce little pears. We grow those pears for their flowers. So the best explanation would be you're looking at a flowering pear that naturally produces fruit about the size of a cherry. That's just as big as they get. We don't grow them for their fruit. We don't eat the fruit. We enjoy their beautiful flowers. So somehow you may be looking at the wrong pear tree. You may be looking at an ornamental pear tree that naturally produces fruit that size. I just don't know. I can't tell you. I would think you'd say, well, gee, Dan, after all these years, we know good and well where that pear tree is. We know what it looks like. We know exactly where it is. And we've gone to it over and over and over again. It is the pear that my grandmother always had. It's not some ornamental pear. It's the one that she always had. And under those circumstances, I can't give you an explanation for that, Travis. I mean, I could see it making smaller pears. It's getting old. You know, it can't make as many. It can't make as big. But they shouldn't shrink down to the size of the pears that are made by ornamental trees. So that tells me this is a flowering pear that you're looking at, and that's about the best I can give you. I don't have an explanation for why.
Okay, that's perfect. It also explains that when I did come upon the tree, it was swarmed with hummingbirds, and they were feasting on flowers, and the smell of the fruit was actually rotten on the ground. So, I think you answered my question, Dan. Thank you.
Well, okay, Travis, that works. All right, thank you for the call.
All right, thanks.
All right, Diane is up next, calling from New Orleans. Good morning, Diane.
Good morning, John. I'm calling about watermelons. I have a relative who was growing watermelon, and most of them had gotten to the size of a baseball, and the back or the end of the watermelon started to turn brown and rot. So is there something that's affecting that vine that can cause the watermelons to die? And is there something we could do to curb that?
It could be fruit rot. What we normally do with watermelons to give them some protection is we put a big old wad of pine straw underneath them, or we may put them on a piece of board, anything to lift them up off the ground and provide a barrier between the soil and the watermelon. Fungal organisms in the soil can splash up from watering or rainfall, particularly rainfall, and there are natural openings on the flower end of the watermelon. Sometimes fungal organisms can find their way in and cause a fruit rot to occur at that point. And that would be one possibility. Diane, they also might want to contact, are they in Louisiana?
No, in Georgia.
Well, tell them to contact their, you know, I'm retired from the LSU Ag Center, and every state has a university program like the LSU Ag Center that delivers information to the people. Horticulturists are a big part of that. So whatever county they're in Georgia, there's a Georgia Cooperative Extension Service office in that county, or at least a regional one, and they'll be able to access a horticulturist that understands their growing conditions, their diseases, what's going on in the home gardens at this point in that area of Georgia. And it's a great way to get information that really applies to you. I'm not sure what's going on in Georgia right now. There may be some disease hitting the watermelons. So tell them to contact their county agent or extension horticulturist in their county with the Georgia State University Cooperative Extension Service, and they'll be able to give them some good information. They could send them photographs, maybe even bring in one of the rotten watermelons so they could take a look at it and get them a diagnosis. If there is a disease going on, a regular fungicide application, a chlorothalonil or one of the other broad-spectrum fungicides might provide some relief, but they do need to get a good diagnosis from a local horticulturist on that.
Okay, and what's the name of the chemical, chloro what?
Daconil is the most common brand name, D-A-C-O-N-I-L.
Okay, all right. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
All righty, Diane. Thanks for the call.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. Everybody, I hear it's time to take a little bitty break. Got some callers on the line. Y'all hang in there because you know your questions are important to me. And if you'd like to call and get your question lined up, that number is 504-260-1870. We'll be back right after this. Feel free to call on in. I'd love to talk to you. Do my best to answer your gardening questions. Let's go out to Gretna and talk to Sam. Sam, good morning. Thanks for calling in.
Hi, Dan. How you doing? I have a couple of questions about moss. They had some mulch we got for our garden. It's Pemco, something like that. The idea is that it's supposed to have enough weed killer in it to suppress the weeds without hurting your plants. Is that something you've heard of?
I'm going to say yes. You know, I'm aware that there are mulches that a pre-emergence herbicide is incorporated in them. Now, when you buy those, you have to read the label very carefully because you're not just buying a mulch, you're buying a pesticide. And you need to make sure that the weed killer that is included in that mulch is going to be safe to use around the kind of plants you intend to put them on. So there'll be a list on the bag of all of the plants that are tolerant and any plants that you have to be careful of that may not be tolerant of that herbicide. And that's about the only difference I could really come up with. Now, it's not as popular to do this, Sam, as you might think. And the reason for that is that the mulch itself is a weed preventer. So you're sort of doubling up on something the mulch does perfectly well on its own without having a weed killer added to it. And the way mulches work is that you put out a couple of 3 inches of mulch. They block the sun from reaching the soil surface. The soil is where the weed seeds are located. When you block the sun from reaching the soil surface, the weed seeds think they're so deep in the soil that they can't germinate, and so they simply never sprout. So mulches suppress the growth of weed seeds from germinating. Now, pre-emergence herbicides, the kind of herbicide that's included in your mulch, kind of do the same thing. They're toxic to the weed seeds. And when the weed seed begins to sprout, the poison in the herbicide kills the germinating weed seed. So that's how they work. So the mulches work by keeping the weed seeds from germinating, and the pre-emergence herbicide works by keeping the weed seeds from germinating. But as long as you have a thick enough mulch, I don't see a really great advantage of adding the pre-emergence herbicide to the mulch. And that's why they're not as common as you might think, because, again, mulches do a good job of doing that on their own without adding a chemical to the process.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering about, because just going the regular mulch route with you know, that weed screen, if you're familiar
Absolutely.
With it.
Absolutely. It'd be a whole lot cheaper. It'll be a whole lot cheaper, too. I'm sure you pay a premium price for a mulch that has the pre-emergence herbicide in it.
for the regular mulch with the weed screen doesn't work at all as far as keeping the weeds out. So that pre-treated mulch, it does have some effect?
Remember, mulches and pre-emergent herbicides control germinating weed seeds. They won't control Bermuda grass running into the bed. They won't control oxalis coming up from bulbs. They won't control any of the weeds that produce perennial underground parts. Those torpedo grass, those weeds will grow right through a mulch, or a torpedo grass could probably puncture a weed barrier. So again, when we're talking about pre-emergent herbicides and mulches, we're talking about them suppressing germinating weed seeds. You could still have a massive problem, even if you mulch properly, if the weeds you're dealing with happens to be, you know, something with rhizomes or bulbs underground, and they're spreading that way, not spreading by seed.
Okay. A shorter mulch question. Around the trees, I work out of town, so I can't tend to the garden, so I'm trying to get as less maintenance as possible. What I did was I mulched around our oak trees so it's less weed eating, since you can't find anybody to cut your grass even anymore. Now, my wife brought up that's going to bring more bugs to the roots of the trees. Because they got more room to hide.
Tell her sweetheart, you know, when trees live in the woods, they drop their leaves over their roots every year, and nobody comes and rakes them up. For a tree to have a layer of organic matter over its roots is their natural, healthy state. That's what a tree really appreciates. Lawns are not a normal state for a tree to be growing in, a layer of organic matter. So you are doing exactly the right thing for the well-being of your trees. Plus, it looks nice. Plus, you're controlling the weeds. It's a win-win situation. Tell her you love her, but you were right.
So it's not necessarily to bring more bugs into underneath the mulch then.
I don't even know what she's talking about when she says brings more bugs.
They got the mulch to hide in, so they got more bugs, you know, nesting in there, you know, in the mulch. That was her reasoning.
And what's the issue?
Bringing more bugs to the roots of the trees than the bugs
Sam, her point is the mulch is detrimental to the health of the tree. That's her point. Cut to the chase.
Yeah.
And the answer to that is
bringing more bugs to the roots of the trees.
The answer is no.
Oh, okay.
No. I mean, now you're arguing for her.
I was explaining why she brought that up.
Well, I'm explaining why
it's no.
And Sam, okay. I'm explaining why it's not an issue. I don't know why it's getting across to you. All right.
Okay.
All righty.
All right, Dan. Thank you. Bye bye.
Sure thing, Sam. Thanks for the call. I wasn't upset. I really was just trying to get my point across. All right. See if we can slip Jenny in here real quick. Jenny, good morning. I've got a little bit of time left. What can I do for you?
Okay. I would like the name of a low maintenance tall evergreen tree for my back fence line in order to block my neighbor's yard. They've cut all their trees, so I've lost all the shade, all the everything, and I have a 6-foot fence, but I need something that's going to grow tall but not be a deciduous tree, low maintenance.
All right, good question, Jenny. To give you the best answer, I need a moment to think about that, and I need to know exactly what your situation is. So I want you to send me an email. That's to dan@wwl.com, and in the email, you've already said you want it to be evergreen. I want you to tell me how tall it wants to be, how sunny the area is. Is it well-drained or low and wet? And let me know a little bit about the situation, and then I can give you some options for you to choose from. And I think you'll get a much better answer if we spend a bit more time with it. How's that sound, Jenny?
That's great. Appreciate your help. Thank you.
Thank you, Jenny. Appreciate the call. Folks, stay tuned. We have a whole other Hour of the Garden Show coming up from 10 to 11, and I'll be back with y'all then after we catch y'all up on the latest news. Stay tuned. Good morning. I appreciate you so much for joining me for the second hour. Lots of good questions and lively discussions in the first hour. And I hope to get your questions here in the second hour as well. Feel free to call on in. You can call me now at the WWL on the mortgage financial phone line, and I'll be happy to answer gardening questions. I wanted to also remind you all a few things you can be doing despite the heat. This is a time of the year to lay lawns. I was talking earlier about repairing damage to lawns, and the best time to do that is you know, when you see a bare area that needs to be repaired. Don't just wait for the grass to grow in. It just likely will not happen. So you can either lay lawns or repair lawns with sod this time of the year. Plant tropicals, including palms. If you've been thinking about adding a palm to your landscape, we plant palms in the heat of summer. So this is a great time to add palms. And, of course, you can continue to add colorful summer bedding plants. You'll find those available at your local nurseries and garden centers and feed stores, and vegetables can be planted as well, heat-tolerant vegetables. And as we move into August, we're looking at planting our fall tomatoes and fall eggplants and fall peppers. So we'll be really gearing up for the fall garden, even though it's still very much summer here in southeast Louisiana. Alrighty, again, if you've got a gardening question, give me a call at 504-260-1870, and we're going to go to the phones. And first up is Shirley. Good morning, Shirley. Thanks for calling in.
Good morning, Dan. My question is on cutting back two plants. One is my yesterday, today, and tomorrow. I cut it back after it bloomed, but I really need to cut it back a little bit more. And I wasn't sure if it was too late to do that. And my hydrangea, I'd like to cut it back now that it's bloomed.
The I go ahead and cut the yesterday, today, and tomorrow back. And again, you're probably not looking at as hard a pruning as you did in the spring.
And if you are,
then and you might want to remember this. You might want to cut it back a little harder in the spring each year, anticipating. Yeah. The growth it's going to make, and that just saves you some work. But otherwise, feel free to give it a trim today would be fine. Now, hydrangeas are like many of the spring flowering shrubs, even though they bloom in early summer. Hydrangeas set their flower buds around about this time of the year, and we usually try to wrap up pruning on them in early to mid-July. So, you know, this is late. If you're really desperate to cut them back and you're okay taking a bit of a risk, feel free to cut them back. Now, you can cut back all of the shoots that produced flowers. They have no flower buds on their tips. But if you find there are leafy shoots that terminate in foliage that are still sticking up too high, only cut back the ones that are really egregious, you know, that you really need to cut down to make the plants look a little bit neater, and try to leave behind as many of the leafy shoots you see unpruned. And I think that's a good compromise to doing some pruning this time of the year. But, yeah, it is late on the hydrangeas.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's why I wanted to check with you to see. All right, Dan.
Well, you don't want to lose them flowers, Shirley. Huh.
No. Especially my yesterday, today, and tomorrow. It's so beautiful. It truly is.
Yeah. One of my favorite plants, too, Shirley. Well, you take care. Thanks for the call.
All right, Dan. Thank you. Bye-bye.
All righty. Bye-bye. Up next is Mary. Good morning, Mary. What can I do for you this morning?
Good morning. I have a sago plant, beautiful and hardy, and because of the rain, it's really growing. It's too close to the house. So one day my daughter left a door open to bring packages in from the trunk, and I looked up and a snake was in the house coming from under that plant. Now, either I get rid of the plant or spray it so that that won't happen again. What can I do? Because I don't want snakes coming in the house from that plant.
No, you sure don't. Mary, you can transplant that sago to some other location or just dig it out if you have no other location. Check around and see if there's any friends or family that might want a nice sago. They're wonderful landscape plants. They grow all over the city. There's nothing about a sago that attracts snakes. I mean, otherwise there'd be snakes everywhere because this is a plant used literally in way over half of the landscapes in the New Orleans area. Again, you see them everywhere. You don't see snakes everywhere. It was just one of those things. A little snake came wandering by, happened to hang out under the sago, happen to find an open door and happen to come into your house, you might never see another snake for the rest of your life. Again, there's nothing about that sago that's like a lighthouse broadcasting, come see me, to all the snakes in the area. That's just not the case. But I understand how people just say, that's it, I've had it, I just don't want this around. That's fine. But if you can, dig it out and give it to somebody, give it a new home. Or if you can't find a new home, just dig it out and, you know, get rid of it. And there's nothing that you can do that would practically keep snakes away from your house, you know, for the rest of your life. It's just there's nothing practical you do on that.
Okay, thank you. I thought it was the plant itself, but it's not the plant.
It was just a coincidence. That could have been an azalea bush sitting there, you know, and the snake crawling up underneath it. Yeah.
But thank you so much. It's so beautiful. I appreciate your help. Thank you.
Mary, I appreciate the call, and good luck. I don't like snakes either. Take care now. All right, Scott is up next. Scott, you're on the Garden Show. What can I do for you?
Good morning, Mr. Gill. I'm calling on behalf of a relative who has what is apparently some sort of a sinkhole in the process of forming. Now, this is just north of I-12 off of Highway 11. The subdivision was established sometime in, I would say, the mid-70s, and he's lived in the house, and a relative has lived in the house since the late 70s. And there's, at a corner of the yard, there's an area approximately 80-foot total area. And
Scott, I'm thinking this is not a plant issue.
Okay. I do notice it actually happens quite frequently. Of course, the thing's filled with water now and tadpoles, which is a good thing. But I notice a stream of bubbles in various locations. Sometimes a stream of bubbles for 2 or 3 minutes.
Yeah, Scott, this is definitely not a plant thing. So you're just outside of my ability to help you with this. Now, that doesn't mean that your relatives don't need help. Talk to them, ask them if they have tried filling the area. If so, how often and how much have they filled it? I mean, have they tried to do something about it? Have they contacted the local councilman? Have they contacted some organization that the neighborhood might have, like a neighborhood association? I mean, there are certainly things that they can do to try to begin to get some handle on, you know, what's going on in that corner of their yard. But it's just not something I could personally help them with my expertise in horticulture. I just don't have a clue.
Okay, well, I appreciate it. I was thinking that it might have been, you know, at one time it may have been a tree. I know there was a tree back there, and the root system is finally in the process of decomposing. But, I mean, it looks like, I would say, roughly 1 cubic yard of dirt.
And Scott, that happens. I had sinkholes in my yard. They had buried tree trunks, you know, parts of trees here and there. And when those decayed, kaboom, the ground went down there. I just filled them up. Filling is the solution to that, because once the wood decays, it's over. It's not ongoing. So all you have to do is just fill it up. Once the wood's all decayed, it's a done deal. So again, if there was a tree there that was removed, well, boom, you've got a good explanation. Just deal with it.
All right. Well, I'll get the wheelbarrow and the shovels ready. I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
I hope it works. Thanks.
Okay.
Appreciate the call. All righty, folks, got to take a quick break. If you're holding on the line, y'all hang in there. It won't be long, and I'd love to get your question. If you'd like to call in with your garden question, you can call me at 504-260-1870. Stay tuned, and we'll be back with more of The Garden Show. Good morning. We're talking gardening, and I'd appreciate hearing from you if you've got a question or a problem that I can help you out with. Call me now at WWL on the Mortgage Financial phone line. That's 504-260-1870. David, calling in from Baton Rouge. You're up next. David, what can I do for you?
Good morning, Mr. Gill. Thank you for your program. I appreciate it.
Y'all all call me Dan. Y'all all keep calling me Mr. Gill. We're just talking over the garden fence, David. Call me Dan. What you got?
I will, Dan, but that's the way I was brought up. But anyhow,
I just took down
a 60-foot water oak in my backyard. My back of my house now is burning up. So I need to I want to plant another tree that's going to give me some fairly quick growth but shade. So I was just curious as to what you would suggest. My family is saying, we need an elm tree. So I'm going to kind of defer to you.
Well, good. Well, let me listen to your family then. Elms as a group, the different species of elms are remarkably fast growing. They're among our faster growing shade trees. We have some nice native elms, American elm, cedar elm. They can be a little hard to find. The elm that really takes off and really makes a nice shade tree is a species from the Far East called the lacebark elm. And it's a really beautiful tree. The leaves are not overly large. They've got a beautiful lustrous color to them. They will make a statement as a shade tree in as little as 5 years. Okay.
Wow.
So David, 5 years is a short time in the life of a tree. So
right.
if you need shade tomorrow, you know, you could look into things like a canopy, you know, big umbrellas, you know, those sorts of things
right.
that might provide some shade on the outdoor living area that you need right away. But to shade your house, the lacebark elm would be a really good choice. There's a cultivar called Drake that's commonly available, but really all of the lacebark elms are good trees. So for fast rate of growth, where that's become a predominant characteristic, then that would be a tree I'd steer you towards. They are deciduous, which is good. We want our shade trees to drop their leaves in the wintertime so the sunshine can shine on our outdoor living areas in our home during the winter when the warmth is more welcome.
Right. Well, thank you so much. I greatly appreciate it.
All right, David, and if you encounter any other thoughts or recommendations or see something that strikes your fancy and you want to run it by me, just send me an email. I'll be happy to take a look at that.
I most certainly will. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Sure thing, David. Renee calling from Metairie. You're next up. Hello, Renee.
Hey, I have a question about – I need – some color in the front of a flower bed that is going to take part sun and through the fall.
You know, pentas are such a wonderful plant. They've got dwarf pentas that will stay around about a foot and a half tall, some taller growing pentas. They're in constant bloom. They're extremely attractive to butterflies. If you plant pentas, you're almost always going to see butterflies. They come in shades of scarlet, red, rose, pink, white, and lavender. A mixture of those colors is beautiful, or you could have a really big impact by choosing one color. So I would steer you towards pentas as being a good choice. Now, there are some others. A lantana would bloom well. There's likely enough sun there for lantanas to bloom. They're also really attractive to butterflies, a good pollinator, nectar-providing plant. The profusion zinnias and Zahara zinnias, they take the heat of summer and will bloom until fall. There are a wide variety that you may see available at your local nursery that may strike your fancy. But pentas, you're bound to love. Clusters of beautiful flowers, and they really have a tremendous stamina, and they're really just so easy to grow. They don't have any major insect or disease problems.
Thank you.
Renee, thanks so much for calling. I love people who want colorful flowers to nourish our souls. Dan, calling in from Metairie. Hey, Dan, good morning. How you doing?
Hello, Dan. Can you hear me?
Hey, I can hear you. How's it going?
Fine, thank you. I don't know if you heard what I said. Good for an old man. You better get used to it. And you better
that's
get used to that.
My response.
Hey, look, you better get used to that, Mr. Gill, son.
Well, what can I say?
Anyway, I have a sweet potato that was starting to sprout in my bag of sweet potatoes, and I cut off about maybe 2 or 3 inches off the sweet potato with the vine coming out and put it in water, and I got some nice roots and all. If I plant this thing, will I get some potatoes?
No, it takes one more step, Dan. You have to actually break off the shoot that is growing out of the piece of sweet potato and stick it in water and root it and then plant that rooted cutting. If there's any piece of the original sweet potato left attached to the vines, they will pour the food that they store into that piece. And when you dig it up, you'll get this big, gross, misshapen, knobby sweet potato looking thing. So you have to go back to just the roots by rooting a cutting. We call those slips, sweet potato slips. It's late in the season, but hey, you've got nothing to lose. So if you want to go ahead and give that a try, they should root easy. And then once they root it in water, then you can try planting them either into the garden or planting them in a pot to let them get used to the soil and then planting them in the garden and go from there.
Okay, listen, I pulled it out the water just now, and I got plenty of roots coming off those little shoots. So just detach. I don't want any sweet potato on those, right? That's what you're telling me?
That's correct. That is it. And if they've already made roots, then you're already there. You just plant them deep enough to cover the roots.
Okay, that's what I wanted to know. And I have
now, the poor things, Dan, the poor things will not be accustomed to sun, direct sun. So put something over them to shade them. For a week or so after you put them into the ground, see if you can erect some little simple shade over them, even a paper bag or something, because they'll probably fry if you put them right out into the full sun.
I'm looking at the one I have here, and I must have 5 or 10 vines on it, like we're talking about, with the roots. How many of those do I want to plant in, say, a half of a barrel type thing, the little plastic half of barrels? I guess it's about 15 gallons.
No more than 3.
Okay. I'll put 4 in case one dies.
There you go. Always have an insurance policy.
Dan, one other quick question, if you don't mind. My say goes, can I take the pups off of them now to make new ones?
Yeah. We treat sagos like we do the palms, and we divide them and fool around with them in the summertime. So this would be a good time to do that, Dan.
And how do I pop them off the tree?
Just use either a knife or a trowel or something sharp, shovel sometimes, to do that. Dan, I got to go. Got a news break coming up, but thanks for the call. And, folks, so we got the CBS News update, and then we'll be back. Good morning. We're talking gardening. Do feel free to join in the show by just dialing on in. That number, 504-260-1870. Up next, Will calling in from New Orleans. Good morning, Will.
Good morning, Dan. Thanks for the show.
What you got?
I want to move my sweet olives, and I wanted to know if I could relocate sweet olives. They're about 8 foot tall, and if I can, if they'll take shade.
They will take some shade. They don't bloom as heavily, and they don't take heavy shade. So, I mean, if it's a spot where it gets some sun during the day, it'll shade during the day, or a lot of dappled light through the day, they'll handle that pretty well. They do prefer, you know, more sun than they prefer shade. But there's a beautiful allee of them at the Botanical Garden that gets shade, a fair amount of shade from live oaks nearby. And they handle it decently. Again, a little more open growing, not as dense or full, and the flowering is not as heavy. But again, really heavy shade where the sun never shines, probably not going to be enough to create a healthy situation for it. The time to move that sweet olive is in the winter when it is dormant. And I would go online and we'll do a little research on transplanting shrubs or transplanting small trees and get some advice on how to do that. You need to get the root system, root ball big enough for the sweet olive to survive. That's the be-all and end-all. If you don't get enough roots,
is not going to make it. If you get enough roots and you take good care of it, it's likely to make it. And as a rule of thumb, we usually come out from the trunk about 9 inches for every inch in diameter of the trunk. So if it's 2 inches in diameter, you'd want to come out about 18 inches and then cut all the way around width from the trunk, and that'll be the size of your root ball. The roots are relatively shallow on trees and shrubs, so you don't have to go down deep, but do try to get down at least about a foot deep and then undercut that. Once you get it up out of the ground, don't let the roots dry out. If some of the soil falls away, it's all right, but do not let the roots dry out even for a moment until you get it back in the ground. Ideally, have its new hole prepared and ready to go and get it right into that that hole right away. You should be fine through the rest of the winter. We get plenty of rain. But next summer, when the heat moves in, that little sweet olive is still going to be establishing. So don't drown or overdo it, but do pay attention to providing it some extra water, especially during drier periods during the summer, through its first year after you transplant it. An 8-foot-tall tree is a job, but I don't think it's overly large for you to successfully be able to move it.
Okay, and one thing about that, I've got 3 of them growing together on a parking strip, so I'll probably have to move them all 3 at once, huh?
Not necessarily, but if it's a parking strip, that may limit how much, you know, of the roots you can't come out. You can only come out as far right. as the parking strip. So that's going right. to affect the size of the root ball that you take. If they're really okay. close together, you can try digging them all up at the same time and then splitting them apart and then planting them separately. But again, watch okay, those roots great. Don't dry out.
Thank you so much.
Good luck, Will.
Thank you.
All right, Mary called it. Oh, Mary, you're going to be up next. We've got to take a little quick break here. Y'all hang in there because, you know, I'd love to talk to you. It won't be long. And y'all, we'll be right back with more of the garden. And we're talking gardening. I'd love to hear from you. If you've got a question I can help you out with, that number once again, 504-260-1870. Mary, calling in from Hammond. You're the next caller up. What can I do for you? Hey, Mary, are you still with us? All righty. Going to have to move. Call us back, Mary. I'm going to move on now to Hannah calling in from Jefferson. Hey, Hannah.
Hey, Dan. Good morning. How are you?
Real good. What you got?
So I have a snail problem. I have tried beer. I've done 2 rounds of snail bait, but with all of the rain, the snail bait kind of, I guess, kept a lot of the moisture, and it turned into like a hairy, moldy fungus. And the snails just went away, and they're killing my flowers.
Yeah, you have to replace the snail bait. It's got to be fresh. I mean, the snails have to eat it, and you wouldn't want to eat that old moldy junk yourself. So, snail baits get wet and go down, just work them into the soil. They won't hurt anything, and put out some fresh snail bait. So when you put out your beer traps, you're putting out a small bowl or a bowl, sinking it into the ground up to its rim, and then you're filling it about halfway full of beer, and you're doing that in the late afternoon or early evening because the snails are active at night. And when you do that, how large a number of snails are you collecting?
I've gotten maybe 4 or 5 per beer can. I've put out about 3 beers.
That's not a massive snail outbreak.
It, to me, it is. My flowers aren't blooming.
Well, snails don't make flowers not bloom.
They're killing them.
Snails don't kill them. Snails just eat holes in the leaves. So if you say, Hannah, are you going to argue with Dan Gill? Are you going to argue with Daniel? Hannah, let me tell you, snails eat holes in the leaves. Now, if you said, Dan, my impatiens have holes in the leaves and they don't look good and the snails are eating them, I've got a problem. We'd be on the same page. but they don't stop plants from blooming. Snails have no ability to make a plant not bloom, and they can't kill a plant. They simply feed on the foliage of the plant, and eating a hole in a leaf doesn't kill the plant. So if your plants are dying, we need to move on from the snails and slugs and figure out what might be going on. For instance, there may be a fungal infection attacking the base of the stems, causing stem rot or root rot. So the plants just kind of fall over and collapse and die. Sound familiar?
Yes, what I'm more specifically, the plants that I have, like, they're purple flowers, and I'm new to gardening, so I don't remember the name of them. They've stopped blooming, and the leaves are turning more yellow than green. And I sprayed them with a antifungal that I just picked up at Lowe's, and they still just, they look sad. And there's a bunch of snails underneath them in the bed. So I just didn't know how frequently I needed to replenish the snail bait.
Number one, Hannah, monitor the population with your traps. If you're catching 10 or 12 snails in a trap every night, you've got a major outbreak, and it warrants putting out some bait. And you have to put out the bait every few nights. Again, it has to be fresh. But the traps alone are going to trap a lot of the snails. Do make sure the bowls are sunk into the ground to make it easy for them to crawl into the bowl. And make sure you're sinking them into the ground close to where the snails are. And if you're finding snails, Hannah, you're telling me you see the snails. Well, for goodness sakes, when you see them, collect them and throw them away. I mean, that's a very effective way of getting rid of snails. So between the bait, collecting, and the traps, your snail and slug problem will be manageable. We'll never be rid of them, but it's manageable. But understand, they are not what is causing the problem with your plants. They're not. They don't make the leaves turn yellow, and they don't make the plants stop blooming. There may be, again, we've had tons of rain, and a plant can turn yellow if its roots aren't functioning right. The roots have to absorb the minerals out of the soil to keep the plants green and healthy. And so if the root system is not happy and functioning well because it's just been so darn wet for so long, that's not something you can really help with unless you think to yourself, next time when I pull these plants out and re-prepare this bed for another planting, I'm going to add some more organic matter and maybe some soil to build this bed up so it drains better in the future. That's something you can do later on. But again, continue your war against the snails and slugs, but remove them as the cause of your problems, the major symptoms that you're seeing right now. They're simply not involved with that.
Okay, thank you so much for your information.
Hannah, you are so welcome. And sometimes I know it's hard when we get something stuck in our mind and it's like, this is what's doing this. It's hard to be dissuaded, but I swear I'm putting you on the right track here.
I trust
what's your situation?
You.
All right, Hannah.
Thank you so much.
All righty. All righty, folks. Let's talk to Cheryl calling in from New Orleans. Good morning, Cheryl.
Good morning, Dan, and I come in peace. I'm not going to debate. I believe everything you say, and that's why I'm calling.
Oh, debate is life. And no. Look, if I can't convince somebody that what I'm telling them is accurate, then I've lost my touch.
And that will never happen. But
and Cheryl, it's so good to hear from you.
Oh, it's good to be heard from, actually. I'm one of the people who received those seeds from nowhere in the mail. And
sure.
What should we do with those seeds?
I guess I'm glad you called, you know, because that is, you know, percolating around out there, and there may be other people. You can send those to Louisiana. You can burn them. That would be one option. You can put them in your oven and bake them until they're dead. The worry that we have right now is that people are going to go, and toss them in the trash. Or, God forbid, even think, oh, these are seeds, let me plant them. And we don't know. There are various kinds of plants. We don't know why they're doing this. We don't know if there's something wrong. We don't know if they're diseases or problems. So either kill the seeds by baking them in the oven or burning them to get rid of them. But whatever you do, do not just throw the seeds away. way. In the trash, there's always a possibility that one way or the other, the container can get torn open, the seeds can come up in the landfill. So either that, I think the Department of Agriculture and Forestry, you can double check their website. They may have some comments on this, the Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry. I know they were trying to get some people to submit seeds that had been sent in so they could get a handle on what was going on. But the main thing is, if you don't want to go to a lot of trouble or anything, is just to make sure you thoroughly destroy the seeds and burn all that up and then be done with it.
Yeah, they look exactly like, you know, they showed you on television what the envelope looks like and everything. And I thought, well, gee, you know, how lucky can you get?
Some of the pictures on TV, I was like going, well, those are sunflower seeds. Oh, those are tomato seeds. I mean, I was recognizing some of the seeds that they were sending in, mustard seeds. And so they're sending a variety of stuff. But the main thing is consider them, you know, absolutely something that we Americans should not allow to take root in our soil. And by all means, do everything you can to destroy them or turn them into someplace like the Department of Agriculture.
Okay, will do. And it's always great to listen to your show. Thank you so much.
Cheryl, it's good to hear your voice, and thank you for that great question. All righty, folks, it's break time, but y'all stay tuned. If you want to call in to get your question lined up, that number to call is 504-260-1870, and we will be right back. Good morning. We're talking gardening, getting a bit down to the wire, but we've got calls on the line, so let's hit the phones. Peter calling in from the West Bank. Good morning. You're up.
Hey, Dan. How you doing this morning? I'm having a little issue with my St. Augustine. It started off with like just a brown spot about the size of maybe a 5 gallon bucket, you know, bottom of a bucket. And now I got two giant patches, probably 6 foot by 6 foot, in just random places in my front yard. And it looks like it's getting worse. You have any idea what you're doing at? I know it's not a watering issue because of all this rain. And you know, last week it got worse and it was pouring down raining all week long.
Yeah, it could be a fungal issue. It could be chinch bugs. It could be the sod webworm I was mentioning is out causing damage to lawns. If the grass blades with chinch bugs, they suck the juice out of the grass, and the grass blades will roll up lengthwise, and then they turn brown. Okay. If you go look at those areas and the leaves have rolled up and it looks straw-like, then that's a chinch bug diagnosis. If you go out there and the grass blades, you get down on your hands and knees, the grass blades have been chewed down to the thatch. Literally, you can see them chewed off. That would be the sod webworm issue. And finally, if the leaf blades are just brown and soft and mushy, they've got brown spots on them. Looking at the edge of the brown area, you can see the grass blades are getting, you know, rotten, decayed looking, getting spots on them. That would all indicate a fungal issue. So this can be dicey. Doing a diagnosis. Again, you could go online, look at some of the symptoms of the three things I've just mentioned, and see if that maybe, look at some photographs, see if that maybe helps you out some. An insecticide like bifenthrin, tall star, would control the chinch bugs or the sod webworms, but if it's a fungus problem, you need to use a fungicide. Finally, you could cut a piece of it out right at the edge so it goes half into the brown and half into the green, bag that up and take that with you to a local nursery or garden center, and they may be able to give you some idea actually looking at that. But don't take it from the middle where everything's dead. Take it from the edge where the symptoms are showing up. That'll be the most helpful.
Okay, I'm thinking chinch bugs because when I cut it yesterday, I could see it was almost like little straw, you know, on the dead pieces. It definitely wasn't like withered down. It was like almost like straw.
Well, treat with an insecticide, and if the area stopped getting bigger, you were right. If they keep getting bigger, you need to pursue it more. Now, that's not going to green back up again. When you're sure you've gotten it under control and everything's stable, rake out that dead stuff and lay new sod to repair the damage.
And that's okay this time of year to do that, with laying new sod? Okay.
Perfect time.
Okay, great,
Dan.
Well, I appreciate it. I'm gonna do the chinch bug, and hopefully that'll take care of it. Thank you so much.
Good luck, Peter. All righty. Jennifer is up next. Hey, Jennifer, good morning.
Hey, Dan, how are you?
I'm good. We're getting down to the wire, but what can I do for you real quick?
So my mom was a master gardener, and she died last year, and I just caught the gardening bug. I found an old journal of hers, and a gardening journal. I know, it's very dear to me. And there's a couple references in the 90s to Sierra tablets. And I don't know if that term is familiar to you, but she seemed to like them, and I was just wondering what they are.
It was Sierra tablets?
I think it was a Sierra, and she mentioned it a couple times as planting underneath plants, almost like a fertilizer or something.
Yeah, it's going to be a fertilizer tablet. Those are usually formulated for aquatic plants. We put them in the containers of aquatic plants. Okay. We usually use granulars and things for planting in beds. But I'm not familiar with that brand, even though I was quite active in the 90s. It doesn't ring a bell
okay.
with me. If you've done an internet search using that brand and you haven't seen any results, then it's very likely it's a product that has come and gone. You could then do an internet search for fertilizer tablets and look at what options are available today. But there's, I have to say, there's nothing really special about fertilizer tablets per se. I'm not sure why she would have kind of latched on to them. They're fine to use for fertilizer, but they're not like the preferred way necessarily of fertilizing plants. But they would provide nutrients over an extended period of time, and that could be a good thing as well. But again, if you don't see Sierra available, you should be able to find fertilizer tablets still available.
Okay, I'll look that up. Thank you so much.
Oh, Jennifer, and the generation goes on. Thank you so much for picking up Gardening Girl. You're going to love it. You take care now. We got Christy. To wrap up, Christy, I have less than a minute. Do you have something really, really fast to ask me?
Yeah, okay. So we've got cypress trees, and the knees are coming up to my property onto the slab. How do I safely get rid of, I guess I'm going to have to cut the tree down, but I want to make sure that those roots are also taken care of.
Yeah, Christy, you can take a shovel or a sharpshooter shovel and cut right along the slab. That will sever any roots that might be growing under the house. Once you take the tree down, the roots are all going to die and stop growing. So just to reassure yourself, just cut right along the slab there with a sharp shovel, and that'll help you out. Thanks, Christy, and thanks to everybody. I'll see y'all again next Saturday right here on The Garden Show.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.